Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the December 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. We're going to start off with an interview with Bruce Springsteen, and then the rise and fall of the band The Fine Young Cannibals, and a classic album review of Black by Metallica. And we start off with the article about Bruce Springsteen titled Exclusive Deliverance. In autumn 2025, the stark landscapes of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska swim back into focus. As its fabled electric version emerges and a Bruce biopic explores the struggles behind the songs. On page 42, director Scott Cooper reveals Springsteen's role in shaping Deliver Me From Nowhere, but not before the boss himself has his say. It was an exploratory period, he tells Warren Zanes. And that affected everything I was doing. As the River Tour, the biggest and most successful of Bruce Springsteen's 31-year-old life, wound down in September 1981, the group that had gone through it all together dispersed. East Street Band guitarist Steve Van Zandt and saxophonist Clarence Clemons would be getting married. Drummer Max Weinberg had done the same that June. Up to that point, we were like a street gang, Weinberg explains to Mojo Today. It seemed like we were together all the time, not a lot of friends outside of the band, and suddenly that stopped. Weinberg remembers the lunch in L.A. where he first told Springsteen he was getting hitched. On one hand, he was really happy for me. On the other, I think he was kind of like, why? With no set plans to record or rehearse, the band went their separate ways. Springsteen moved into a small rental house in Colts Neck, New Jersey. I didn't know where he lived, says Weinberg. It was almost like he didn't want anyone to know where he lived. One person who did know was Mike Batlin, Springsteen's roadie, and more. It was Batlin who helped Bruce set up a TEAC 144-4 track recorder in the rental home's bedroom. I can see what Max is saying, Batlin tells me. People are getting married and going off into these lives outside of, you know, the band only. I'm sure Bruce was reflecting on it. Some of that I could see, just sitting there in the bedroom with him. We'd all go to these weddings. I had this beautiful girlfriend at the time. I distinctly remember being at one of them. Bruce giving me a little poke in the side saying, when's your turn, Mike? And me laughing nervously. It was all just changing. We were getting older. It was a sound man at the Stone Pony Music Club in Ashbury Park, already a significant location in Springsteen's life, who showed Batlin's picture of the TEAC 144 in Musicians magazine ad. With that machine, Batlin would, in the months after the River Tour, record the songs that would comprise Nebraska. For what could have been a quiet release, a departure meant to show another side of a beloved artist, a collection of recordings originally meant to be demos only. Nebraska wasn't quiet. Instead, since the album's original release in September 1982, it's only raised its voice assuming a very central place in the narrative surrounding Springsteen's creative life. Springsteen has said that the album still may be my best. Its making has become a thing of legend and lore. Other than Springsteen, Baleen was the only person in the room when the recording took place. When Bruce first told me they'd be putting out the bedroom recordings, I was confused, Batlin recalls. He called me up to tell me. I said, "You mean the work tapes?" Bruce laughed. He knew I'd be shocked. I've reflected on it since. Understand that this was one of those turning points in music, but I didn't realize it at the time. I'm just there to help out. I'd never used a TEAC 144, and I wanted to get it right. Normally, a work tape would be intended as a reference, something the band could listen to before they recut the material in a proper commercial studio. In this instance, the power station in Manhattan's Hell Kitchen. In an unexpected reversal, the reference tape became the official release, and the re-recordings of those demos that fans came to call the Electric Nebraska went into the vaults. As with so many things hidden from view, the mythic power of those re-recordings seemed to grow over the years. For his part, Springsteen was too busy to go back there to forage, eventually forgetting that there was anything back there at all. That all changes this week with the release of Nebraska 82 Expanded Edition, which includes a 2025 remaster of the original album, the disc of outtakes from Springsteen's original Colt's Neck Bedroom Sessions, and new versions of the Nebraska songs recorded in the Count Basie Theater, Red Bank, New Jersey, in the spring of 2025 and filmed for Blu-ray by Tom Zimmy, director of previous Springsteen film projects, including Letter to You and Springsteen on Broadway. Most intriguing of all is the inclusion of 8 songs recorded at the Power Station with the E Street Band in 1982, the so-called Electric Nebraska. First question for Springsteen then, were there any particular surprises for him in among those recordings? "It was all surprises," he tells Mojo. "I didn't know they existed. I was taken aback when I found out Electric Nebraska was something real, that we'd gone as far as we had. There's always a lot going on, and you're generally moving toward the next thing. But we went back and found the tapes, and it was a bit of a shock. It was a surprise to me, and I think it'll be a surprise to fans." "Did you have any hesitation in releasing the recordings because the act of releasing them might diminish the mystery?" "No, no hesitation, not at this point. First of all, I don't think releasing the recordings does diminish that. I think it enhances the mysterious quality, that almost mystic aspect. Fans have, for a long time, had ideas about what they thought we were doing electrically in the studio at that time. Releasing the tracks now doesn't change the situation a whole lot, oddly enough, just gives people more to work with. None of us can go back there, really go all the way back there. We can only try to piece it together. I mean, the electric and acoustic versions are mysterious to me. Still, just the way that music sounds. It's not like anything else the E Street Band and myself have ever done. It's remarkable to see Nebraska have this. I was going to say Second Life, but Nebraska's been having different lives for over 40 years. Yeah, absolutely, that's true. For me, it's in a special class of recordings, like music from Big Pink, maybe Astro Weeks, Columbia's first release of the Basement Tapes, recordings that seem to belong to no distinct time or place. Are there albums like that for you? Those are all good calls. I hear that in those albums. I don't think it's a planned effect, a thing done self-consciously. Self-consciousness would probably ruin that effect. I've described Nebraska as an accident, start to finish. But I would say that, like Nebraska, the Electric Nebraska recordings have a strange sort of timelessness. You can't quite pin them down as something done in the 80s. It doesn't sound like anything from that time. It was just a unique moment. Whenever I was turning my attention to just then, it was way outside the boundaries of what I'd been doing, both in the acoustic material that became the album and the electric material that we didn't release. They were both at a distance from what I'd been doing with the band up to that time, and both seem like they belonged to another place and time, even to me. And here's a little bit of the song Nebraska from his new release album, Electric Nebraska.
I saw her standing on her front lawn, just a twirling her baton. Me and her went for a ride, sir, and 10 innocent people died. From the town of Lincoln, Nebraska, with a sawed-off 410 on my lap, to the badlands of Wyoming, I killed everything in my path.
The Christian Dior Summer 2026 fashion line, featuring the work of designer Jonathan Anderson, was unveiled at the Hotel National des Invalides in Paris this past June. The show opened to the sound of State Trooper, track 6 from Nebraska. Male models, sombre, a bit menacing, and a little sallow, took to the runway as Springsteen's suicide-inspired scream brought the room to attention. The room itself, vast, filled with those who attend such gatherings, had light-stained wood floors and walls painted white. The only images on the walls were on loan from the Louvre and the National Gallery of Scotland. Two still lives by Jean Simon Cardian, both from the 18th century and masterworks of the genre. More evidence of the strange life Nebraska has been leading since it came out 40 years ago. And here's the electric version of that song, State Trooper.
New Jersey Turnpike, riding on a wet night, neath the refinery's glow, out where the great black rivers flow. License registration, I ain't got none, but I got a clear conscience about the things that I done. Mr. State Trooper, please don't stop me. Please don't stop me. Please don't stop me.
The Nebraska 82 box arrives as part of That Strange Life. And just as the Scott Cooper directed film Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, is about to hit cinemas, having turned down previous opportunities to enter into the potential fraught world of the biopic, Springsteen, speaking at the Telluride Film Festival in August, explained why he finally felt ready to be part of such an experience. I'm old, and I don't give a fuck. Even if one takes his point, Springsteen will never be mistaken for a man who doesn't give a fuck. Over the last few years, he's behaved like an artist, eager and open and ready to participate in considering who he is, what he's doing, and what he has done for the past 50 plus years. He gives a fuck, just in a different way than he once did. In pondering something like State Trooper's gate crashing of the Dior show, he no doubt finds himself having to answer and ask questions about these songs going renaissance. Nebraska could have been seen as little more than a rest stop on the way to June 1984's Born in the USA, his multi-platinum sales peak. But it seems to have had and continues to have a plan of its own, refusing the simple life of a work that might otherwise be considered interstellar. It shows up in unlikely places, resonating differently wherever it goes. And its travel has not gone unnoticed by Springsteen himself. I'm going to send you something tonight, he tells me. It's the trailer for an HBO superhero series, which I don't think I can name. They just sent it to me. It's something I've never seen before, you know. And it also uses State Trooper, if in a very different way than the Dior fashion show. You'll get a kick out of hearing it. It surprises me how Nebraska's songs can migrate into so many different situations. Yeah, well, the stuff is really basic, and I think its basicness made it very flexible. It can come from any time, go to a lot of places. What they did in the HBO series and in the Dior show is they electrified it to different degrees, adding ambient sounds and synthesizers, and just bringing it somewhere other than where it came from. Quite effectively, I think. Is that one of the reasons you originally set the electric versions aside? Because those versions didn't have that basicness? Well, no, not really. I actually think the Electric Nebraska recordings do have that quality. For most of the electric versions, we cut the band down to three pieces, and they were just howling. It's this very primitive sort of rock and roll. When I went back and listened to it, I was shocked to find that that's the way that I approached it at that particular moment. I hadn't listened in many years, didn't even know the tapes were there, like I said. And they sound pretty damn good. When I heard that stuff, it became really clear that it was never about the Electric Nebraska being bad, being less than in any way. It was about what I was pursuing, and pursuing deeply, that I'd gotten on the bedroom tape. I'd come up against something that caught me by surprise and had me in some kind of grip. And that's what I wanted to focus on at that time. Max Weinberg recalls the first time he heard Nebraska songs handed to him on cassette by Springsteen. "I remember hearing the demo," Weinberg explains, "because Bruce wanted to give me a sense for it, so I could think about what to do on the drums." Springsteen's manager, John Landau, suggested I listen to Dylan's John Wesley Harding as a reference. I'd recently come back from a month in Jamaica with my wife, Becky, where I'd been playing on a practice pad every day for hours, knowing we'd be recording. I said to myself, whatever we're doing, I want to be great on every track. I was primed to go in there. We cut several things with just me, Gary, talent bass, and Bruce. It sounded great, really great. Mike Batlin, at the power station, even when the band wasn't, saw the turn when the recordings Weinberg so believed in were set aside, and the bedroom demos became the focus. Bruce had discussions with John in the control room, Batlin explains, and I could tell from those discussions that Bruce was not feeling it for the Electric sessions. They weren't getting across what he was trying to do. I had to be there all the time, so I was privy to that, but not participating in it, of course. But even being privy to the discussions, I didn't see where it was going. What was coming? The idea of releasing the work tapes wasn't an idea I could have imagined anyone having. The Electric Nebraska recordings would have made a very interesting record, Springsteen reflects. It certainly wasn't Born in the USA, but it wasn't Nebraska either. We cut almost three quarters of an album in that style. It's the most primitive stuff we ever recorded. But it was an album that didn't draw me at the moment. I have more interest in it now, you know. The singer on Electric Nebraska, he's coming up pretty close to us. Maybe a bit volatile, a little insistent. There's something wild in the personality. Well, it's a much wilder vocal approach, so it gives a different sense for the personality behind it. But it's sort of testing the boundaries of what I'd done electrically up to that point. Even if we put it on the shelf, it was a meaningful experience of seeing what else I could do with my voice as a singer, and as a writer. It was an exploratory period, and that affected everything I was doing, bedroom and studio. Maybe it's rock criticism that particularly responsible for a good/bad framework. Nebraska is one of those examples of an artist releasing a recording that is, by standard measures, flawed, even though he has these other correct versions in the can. Well, there's no way to fully and comprehend, understand why one recording seems to be speaking in the right tongue and another isn't. There are too many factors to consider. But I knew without question that just then, At that moment in my life, the bedroom recordings of the Nebraska songs were the ones. There was no other way to go. Were there better than the electric versions? That wasn't even the question. The bedroom recordings did something for me that no other version of the songs seemed to be doing. That was the only measure I could go by. In 1982, Max Weinberg was a little nonplussed when Nebraska's band session recordings were canned. "We always got results in the studio," he insists, "even when the studio itself wasn't technically up to par." But that whole conversation about releasing the bedroom recordings between Bruce and John, Steve Van Zandt, and producer Chuck Ploskin, I wasn't a part of that. From my perspective, it was an almost instant changeover when they decided to go with the demos. A decision was made. What we had done was great. It wasn't that it was bad. It just didn't have the mysticism, the confusion, and the total lack of self-consciousness of the demos. It wasn't the first time Springsteen and the E String Band had chased some special quality that they heard in a demo. It's an occupational hazard among record makers. But when those situations arose, they didn't release the demos. Nebraska was the exception. Springsteen was focused on the characters in the songs, not the quality of the recordings. What did the characters need? That was his only question. In the absence of evidence, however, there's been some lingering sense among fans that the mythic Electric Nebraska must have shared aesthetic qualities with the contemporaries born in the USA. The actual recordings tell us otherwise. As Springsteen described it, it was neither Nebraska, but born in the USA. But a third thing altogether. The spare, elemental tracks are closer to rockabilly, even if the lyrics pull in another direction. Certainly, the psychological dimension of the bedroom recordings, the sense of the distant change with the more immediate, muscular sound of a small combo. It's a different intensity. There's a menace, but the menace changes when it's no longer one man in a room. Gone is the uneasy interiority of the bedroom recordings. Absent, too, are the synthesizers and gated snares associated with Born in the USA sound. How do you differentiate between the approaches of Born in the USA and Electric Nebraska? If you listen to the electric version of Born in the USA, that's coming out on Electric Nebraska. It takes off from the bedroom recording of the song. Those two versions of Born in the USA from Nebraska and Electric Nebraska are closely related. It's obviously a leap to the version of the song that we put on Born in the USA. Quite a leap. So the first thing I'd say is that the Electric Nebraska record has nothing, really nothing, to do with the actual Born in the USA recordings. Those are the Born in the USA recordings. These are the Electric Nebraska recordings, and they're not the same. But if you listen to, say, Reason to Believe, the Electric Nebraska version goes to a very different place than the bedroom recordings, particularly when the band kicks in, which really isn't the full band, but a small group carved out from the larger group. And here's a little bit of that song, Reason to Believe, from the Electric Nebraska.
Seen a man standing over a dead dog, man by the highway in a ditch. He's looking down, kind of puzzled,
poking that dog with a stick. Got his car door flung open. He's standing out on Highway 31. Like if he stood there long enough, that dog get up and run. Struck me kind of funny, kind of funny, yes indeed. Now at the end of every hard-earned day, people find some reason to believe. Mary Lou loved Johnny with a love mean and true. She said, baby, I'll work for you every day, bring my money home to you. One day up and left her, and ever since of that, she waits down the end of that dirt road for young Johnny to come back. Now it seems kind of funny, seems kind of funny to me. At the end of every hard-earned day, people find some reason to believe. Take a baby to.
So you had three different things cooking, three credible approaches asserting themselves. I really did. But you don't go into making an album, at least I don't, knowing what you're going to find. You go in looking for something without getting to know in advance what it's going to be. I was doing a lot of searching in that period, and I found three roads I could take. All appealed to me, called to me, but one more than the others. As the listener delves into Electric Nebraska, the binary of Nebraska versus Born in the USA reveals itself as more and more untenable. Open All Night and Reason to Believe feature Springsteen's clean Telecaster up front in the mix, with Talent and Weinberg, the simple, steady rhythm section behind him, all of it making for a lean production. Atlantic City builds from that, Stephen Van Zandt's harmony signaling a greater East Street presence, but even that production remains skeletal. Johnny 99 and the frantic Downbound Train adds piano, but the singer's space remains notably uncluttered. Mansion on the Hill leans toward a folk country feel, though a Hammond organ alters that to a degree. But amidst it all, and most significantly, there's a decided cohesion to the various tracks when taken all together. And here's the electric version of Johnny 99.
Well, they closed down the Fort Blount Mall while they died, Mom. Johnny went out looking for a job, but he couldn't find none. He came home too drunk from mixing Tanqueray and wine. Got a gun, shot a night clerk, now they call him Johnny 99. Hey, was down in a part of town with a red light, buddy, you don't stop. Within a gun around and threatened and a blow his top. When an off-duty cop snuck up on him from behind, right there in front of the club tip-top, he slapped the cuffs on Johnny 99. Well, the city supplied a public defender, but the judge was mean John Brown. He came into the courtroom and stared poor John.
It's striking how close Springsteen was to having a complete album, one with a distinct identity stepping up to assert itself. There's an immediacy, a presence that's unlike Nebraska, just as that small combo wild rockabilly feel is unlike anything on Born in the USA. Springsteen wasn't in two places at once as he looked at Cover Me, I'm on Fire, Highway Patrolman, State Trooper, and the others. He was in three. More recently, out at Telluride with wife and E Street bandmate Patty Scalifa, he found himself listening to the original Nebraska, still pondering those songs today. The third and fifth disc of Nebraska 82 bear audio and visual witness to his recent findings, as Tom Zimmy captures him alone, playing them in album sequence and with the extremely minimal backing of East Street Band keyboards player, accordist Charles Gordiano, and former Dylan guitarist Larry Campbell, in the empty Count Basie Theater, 20 minutes from Colt's Neck. There was no audience, so you're not trying to get anyone to respond in any particular way, says Springsteen. That made it more of an interior experience. For Nebraska, that was the right way to go. I just wanted the silence and the music, which is what you get on the record. How did it feel to go into those songs? I wanted to be as true to what happened in the bedroom as I could. Charlie Gordiano and Larry Campbell, both great sensitive players, added a little, played some of the things I'd originally done as overdubs, but mostly it was all done to give me a sense of being alone, just like it was back then. The voice I used at the Count Basie had 40 years on it, of course. When listened to the album, I heard the voice of a 31-year-old, a different tonality, but I just tried to stick as close as I could to the blueprint of the record. Listening back, do you feel some tenderness for that guy? Yeah, because he sounded so young, and yet, you know, the songs are so, they're complex. Yeah, it was interesting. So young. Now the article, The Rise and Fall of the Fine Young Cannibals. When ska pop contenders The Beat ended in July 83, bassist David Steele and guitarist Andy Cox were cut adrift. Then they found frontman Roland Gift, lifted a name from a Natalie Wood movie, and reemerged as Fine Young Cannibals. 1985 UK hit Johnny Comes Home was followed by international mega smash She Drives Me Crazy in 1989. We didn't think it would go that mad, recall the band of multi-million sales, Hollywood A-list fans, and bendy legs dancing. We didn't know how to manage the energy that we'd created. Here's some of the song She Drives Me Crazy by the Fine Young Cannibals. Gift. The story I was told by David and Andy was that The Beat had had some success and they were going to sign a much bigger deal. But then frontman David Wakeling and Ranking Roger turned around to the label and said, "We're the talent, sign us." David Steele, "We were shocked. We just supported David Bowie in Milton Keynes on July the 2nd and 3rd, 1983. Then Dave put a letter under the door saying they were leaving. Dave Wakeling. After the third Beat LP, Special Beat Service, some people were very tired of touring America. I think mainly David wanted a couple of years off to sit, live life, and write songs. Virgin Records were trying to offer the Beat a deal, and eventually they called me and Roger down and said, if it's taken you blokes 6 months to agree a record deal, you don't really want one. Would you like to do something? And that was the start of next band, General Public. David, me, Andy, Cox guitarist, and Everett Morton drummer were very close, so we decided to do something else. I suppose there was a bit of, well, we're going to show you. It was a lot harder than we thought. We went through a lot of singers. Roland. They had an advert running on MTV to help them find a singer. They got loads of cassette tapes. I'd played saxophone in a band in Hull called the Akrulzies. We supported the Beat, so I knew David and Andy, and I got the phone call asking if I'd like to come up. Andy Cox. We didn't know he could sing. We gave him a cassette with some rough tunes. He came back a few weeks later, and we sat in David's front room with a piano. He started singing, and we all burst laughing because we knew it was going to be good. Roland. Everett lost faith fairly early on, though I think it was difficult for him because he wasn't a writer, and we weren't playing any gigs, so he left not long after that. David. Nobody was interested in us. John Mostryn. Andy played me a tape with Johnny. He said, we've had 50 rejections. Then a friend, who was a music researcher for TV pop show The Tube, called and said, anything interesting happening in Birmingham? Magnificent timing. They recorded a video of the boys playing Johnny in this little studio in Birmingham. Broadcast late 84, viewers were struck by Cox's distinctive rubber legs dancing style, as was Gift. David, once The Tube had gone out, it went mental. Every record label in England wanted to sign us. Colin Bell, Tracy Bennett, London Records boss, had tried to sign the Beat, so we knew David and Andy. I think that's what gave us the edge when it came to signing them. David was the thoughtful, inventive, creative one. Andy was the steady, sane person who held it all together, and Roland was just pure charisma. I remember as soon as he walked into the office the first time, it was like, what the fuck? Who is that? Especially from the girls in the office. Roland. When Johnny Comes Home hit UK number 8 in July 1985, going on Top of the Pops was exciting. But you quickly get used to it. It was great, though I remember we did BBC chat show Wogan one night, recorded it at 7, and then got straight on the plane to play Borrowlands in Glasgow, which was heaving. We had success with the first album, Fine Young Cannibals, reaching UK number 1 in February 1986. But then there was a bit of a dip. April 86 single, Funny How Love, is scrapped in at 58. I remember going to the shop in Birmingham and hearing the shop assistant talking, is that the guy from the group? Yeah, One Hit Wonders. Here's some of the song Johnny Come Home by the Fine Young Cannibals. We'll be right back. David, I think the success of Johnny threw us. You have to come up with something better, or it's considered a failure. Roland, after the first album, I think a bit of frisson developed. I'd done acting, so I did 1987 Stephen Frears film, Sammy and the Rosie Get Laid. I was told that David was upset that I'd done that. So the record company agreed to do their side thing, two men, a drum machine, and a trumpet. Cox and Steele's house track, Tired of Getting Pushed Around, was a UK top 20 hit in February 1988. Looking back, I think neither of those was good for the group. Three is a funny number. There's always going to be someone left out. Whether that's in bed or at the dinner table, someone is going to feel rejected. John, it was taking longer than I thought to do a second record. The boys had done a version of Buzzcocks' Ever Fallen in Love for Jonathan Demme's 1986 film Something Wild. UK number 9 in April 1987. Then we had this amazing bit of luck. Director Barry Levinson was driving around Baltimore looking for locations for 1987 film Tin Men. He saw our cassette at a petrol station and thought, that's an odd name. He bought it and stuck it on in his car, and by the time it had finished, he decided that he had to have this band in his next film. David, Barry Levinson asked us to do the score for Tin Men. He wanted that slightly old 60s sound that we were starting to move away from. So that's how July 89 U.S. number 1, Good Thing, came about. That was done for the film, but it sounded great, so we kept it. At one point, we thought about doing a soul side and then a more modern side for the second album. One would be the raw and the other the cooked. It didn't work, but we kept the title. We didn't want to work with a producer again, but the label were giving us heavy pressure to finish the record. So we said, if you get us Prince, then we'll do it. Here's a little bit of that song, Good Thing, by the Fine Young Cannibals. David Rifkin. I'd worked with Prince in the beginning, recording the demos that got him signed. I'd moved back to Minneapolis, so when he built his studio, I was happy working out of there. We shipped the cannabis in from London to Paisley Park, where there was nothing for them to do except go to the studio and work. Roland, it was in the middle of nowhere. It was a bit like being in one of these out-of-town shopping malls, all new and purpose-built. They had big sound stage and a basketball court. I remember having a really bad headache because we'd been heading the ball into the basket. David, Paisley Park was like being a Star Wars fan inside the mothership. If there's Trekkies, then I'm a princey. David, they'd sent me some demos of their songs. One of them was called She's My Baby. They didn't think it was a good song. I said, you can't throw that stuff out. It's too powerful, David. Change the lyrics to She Drives Me Crazy. And out of the blue, everyone understood it. David, when we got back to London with it, everyone was like, whoa, this is going to be big. She Drives Me Crazy was everywhere. And reached number one in April 1989 and in June 1989. The Raw and the Cooked went to number one in America. It was like being a Sunday league club who suddenly signed Ronaldo, like winning the Grand National. We didn't think it would go that mad. Adele was the first person to break our record. David, the good thing about the beat was that we just split up, whereas the Cannibals, we tried to make a third record in the early 90s. I had a lot of music, some good, some not so good. I think Roland was finding it hard to write lyrics. It was going to be impossible to beat She Drives Me Crazy. Roland, we were working on a song in the studio, and in the evening, I went to a screening of 1996 film Stealing Beauty by Bernardo Bucelli. David and Andy were there. Afterwards, I said, "This is ridiculous. You knew we were coming, and I knew I was coming, and we didn't mention it. That was the end for me. I think we could have done more, but we didn't know how to manage the energy that we'd created." David, by then, we weren't really a band. There was this weird chemistry, which did work really well, but we just didn't have it at the end. Now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Metallica's album, fifth album, called The Black Album, 1981. Metallica was the band, Metallica's fifth album, released August 12, 1991, through Elektra Records. It's also called The Black Album because of its largely black and featureless cover. Only the band's logo and Coiled Snake are barely visible. The album was their first commercial success. The Black Album was a controversial album amongst fans and the band. While the album and the band were critically and commercially praised, many fans expressed disappointment and outrage at the new direction taken by Metallica. Gone, for the most part, were the searing riffs, intense speeds, and lyrical themes of such the first four albums. The Black Album presented a more mature, radio-friendly, commercially accessible Metallica, evidenced by the ballad Nothing Else Matters, a song that is about being on the road all the time. Here's part of that song, Nothing Else Matters, by Metallica. Metallica won their first ever Grammy Award for the Black Album in the Best Hard Rock / Heavy Metal category. The Black Album got to number one straight away on the Billboard album charts in 1991, and the album had good commercial success with the singles for the rest of the 2 years ahead, like Enter Sandman, Don't Tread on Me, Nothing Else Matters, Sad But True, The Unforgiven, and Wherever I May Roam. And here's a little bit of the song, Enter Sandman, by Metallica. Thank you. This song, Sad But True, is another release of this album and is slightly heavier than Enter Sandman. The rhythm is very metal-based with guitaring full of hammer-ons and palm muting, but much slower than their early work. The lyrics here are really good. For example, you're my mask, you're my cover, my shelter. You're the one who's blamed. Do my work, do my dirty work, scapegoat. Do my deeds, for you're the one who's shamed. Here's a little bit of that song, Sad But True, by Metallica. And once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the December 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to read a long article about John Lennon and Yoko Ono between 1971 and 1973, and then a classic album review of Sunday at the Village Vanguard by Bill Evans. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music, saying so long and keep rocking.